Side 2, The Robots of Dawn. Continuing, on page 40. Daniil said, "It would not be possible at all for any human being."
"Why not?"
"Surely, Partner Elijah, you are aware that the robotic skeleton is metallic in nature and much stronger than human bone. Our movements are more strongly powered, faster, and more delicately controlled. The third law of robotics states a robot must protect its own existence. An assault by a human being could easily be fended off. The strongest human being could be immobilized. Nor is it likely that a robot can be caught unaware. We are always aware of human beings. We could not fulfill our functions otherwise."
Bailey said, "Come now, Daniil, the third law states a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. The second law states a robot must obey the orders given it by a human being, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And the first law states a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. A human being could order a robot to destroy himself, and a robot would then use his own strength to smash his own skull. And if a human being attacked a robot, that robot could not fend off the attack without harming the human being, which would violate first law."
Daniil said, "You are, I suppose, thinking of Earth's robots. On Aurora, or on any of the spacer worlds, robots are regarded more highly than on Earth, and are in general more complex, versatile, and valuable. The third law is distinctly stronger in comparison to the second law on spacer worlds than it is on Earth. An order for self-destruction would be questioned, and there would have to be a truly legitimate reason for it to be carried through, a clear and present danger. And in fending off an attack, the first law would not be violated, for Auroran robots are deft enough to immobilize a human being without hurting him."
"Suppose, though, that a human being maintained that unless a robot destroyed himself, he, the human being, would be destroyed. Would not the robot then destroy himself?"
"An Auroran robot would surely question a mere statement to that effect. There would have to be clear evidence of the possible destruction of a human being."
"Might not a human being be sufficiently subtle to so arrange matters in such a way as to make it seem to a robot that that human being was indeed in great danger? Is it the ingenuity that would be required that makes you eliminate the unintelligent, inexperienced, and young?"
And Daniil said, "No, Partner Elijah, it is not."
"Is there an error in my reasoning?"
"None."
"Then the error may lie in my assumption that he was physically damaged. He was not in actual fact physically damaged, is that right?"
"Yes, Partner Elijah."
That meant Demacek had her facts straight, Bailey thought. In that case, Daniil, Jander was mentally damaged. Roblox, total and irreversible.
Roblox?
Short for robot block, the permanent shutdown of the functioning of the positronic pathways.
"We do not use the word roblox on Aurora, Partner Elijah."
"What do you say?"
"We say mental freeze out."
"Either way, it is the same phenomenon being described."
"It might be wise, Partner Elijah, to use our expression, or the Aurorans you speak to may not understand. Conversation may be impeded. You stated a short while ago that different words make a difference."
"Very well, I will say freeze out. Could such a thing happen spontaneously?"
"Yes, but the chances are infinitesimally small, roboticists say. As a humaniform robot, I can report that I have never myself experienced any effect that could even approach mental freeze-out."
"Then one must assume that a human being deliberately set up a situation in which mental freeze-out would take place."
"That is precisely what Dr. Fastolf's opposition contends, Partner Elijah."
"And since this would take robotic training, experience, and skill, the unintelligent, the inexperienced, and the young cannot have been responsible."
"That is the natural reasoning, Partner Elijah."
"It might even be possible to list the number of human beings on Aurora with sufficient skill, and thus set up a group of suspects that might not be very large in number."
"That has, in actual fact, been done, Partner Elijah."
"And how long is the list?"
"The longest list suggested contains only one name." It was Bailey's turn to pause. His brows drew together in an angry frown, and he said, quite explosively, "Only one name." Daniil said quietly, "Only one name, Partner Elijah. That is the judgment of Dr. Han Fastolf, who is Aurora's greatest theoretical roboticist."
"But what is then the mystery in all this? Whose is the one name?"
R. Daniil said, "Why, that of Dr. Han Fastolf, of course. I have just stated that he is Aurora's greatest theoretical roboticist, and in Dr. Fastolf's professional opinion, he himself is the only one who could possibly have maneuvered Jander Panel into total mental freeze-out without leaving any sign of the process. However, Dr. Fastolf also states that he did not do it."
"But that no one else could have either?"
"Indeed, Partner Elijah. There lies the mystery."
"And what if Dr. Fastolf..."
Bailey paused. There would be no point in asking Daniil if Dr. Fastolf was lying or was somehow mistaken, either in his own judgment that no one but he could have done it, or in the statement that he himself had not done it. Daniil had been programmed by Fastolf, and there would be no chance that the programming included the ability to doubt the programmer. Bailey said, therefore, with as close an approach to mildness as he could manage,
"I will think about this, Daniil, and we will talk again."
"That is well, Partner Elijah. It is, in any case, time for sleep, since it is possible that on Aurora the pressure of events may force an irregular schedule upon you. It would be wise to seize the opportunity for sleep now. I will show you how one produces a bed, and how one manages the bedclothes."
"Thank you, Daniil," muttered Bailey.
He was under no illusion that sleep would come easily. He was being sent to Aurora for the specific purpose of demonstrating that Fastolf was innocent of roboticide, and success in that was required for Earth's continued security, and, much less important but equally dear to Bailey's heart, for the continued prospering of Bailey's own career. Yet, even before reaching Aurora, he had discovered that Fastolf had virtually confessed to the crime. 8. Bailey did sleep, eventually, after Daniil demonstrated how to reduce the field intensity that served as a form of pseudo-gravity. This was not true anti-gravity, and it consumed so much energy that the process could only be used at restricted times and under unusual conditions. Daniil was not programmed to be able to explain the manner in which this worked, and if he had, Bailey was quite certain he would not have understood it. Fortunately, the controls could be operated without any understanding of the scientific justification. Daniil said, "The field intensity cannot be reduced to zero, at least not by these controls. Sleeping under zero gravity is not in any case comfortable, certainly not for those inexperienced in space travel. What one needs is an intensity low enough to give one a feeling of freedom from the pressure of one's own weight, but high enough to maintain an up-down orientation. The level varies with the individual. Most people would feel most comfortable at the minimum intensity allowed by the control, but you might find that on first use you would wish a higher intensity so that you might retain the familiarity of the weight sensation to a somewhat greater extent. Simply experiment with different levels and find the one that suits." Lost in the novelty of the sensation, Bailey found his mind drifting away from the problem of Fastolf's affirmation, denial, even as his body drifted away from wakefulness. Perhaps the two were one process. He dreamed he was back on Earth, of course, moving along an expressway, but not in one of the seats. Rather, he was floating along beside the high-speed strip, just over the head of the moving people, gaining on them slightly. None of the ground-bound people seemed surprised, none looked up at him. It was a rather pleasant sensation, and he missed it upon waking. After breakfast the following morning... Was it morning, actually? Could it be morning, or any other time of day in space? Clearly it couldn't. He thought a while and decided he would define morning as the time after waking, and he would define breakfast as the meal eaten after waking, and abandon specific timekeeping as objectively unimportant, for him at least, if not for the ship. After breakfast, then, the following morning, he studied the news sheets offered him only long enough to see that they said nothing about the roboticide on Aurora, and then turned to those book films that had been brought to him the previous day, Wake Period, by Giscard. He chose those whose titles sounded historical, and after viewing through several hastily, he decided that Giscard had brought him books for adolescents. They were heavily illustrated and simply written.
He wondered if that was Giscard's estimate of Balin's intelligence, or perhaps of his needs. After some thought, Bailey decided that Giscard, in his robotic innocence, had chosen well, and that there was no point in brooding over a possible insult. He settled down to viewing with greater concentration, and noted at once that Daniil was viewing the book film with him. Actual curiosity, or just to keep his eyes occupied? Daniil did not once ask to have a page repeated, nor did he stop to ask a question. Presumably, he merely accepted what he read with robotic trust, and did not permit himself the luxury of either doubt or curiosity. Bailey did not ask Daniil any questions concerning what he read, though he did ask for instructions on the operation of the printout mechanism of the Auroran viewer, with which he was not familiar. Occasionally, Bailey stopped to make use of the small room that adjoined his room and could be used for the various private physiological functions, so private that the room was referred to as the personal, with the capital letter always understood, both on Earth and, as Bailey discovered when Daniil referred to it, on Aurora. It was just large enough for one person, which made it bewildering to a city dweller accustomed to huge banks of urinals, excretory seats, wash basins, and showers. In viewing the book films, Bailey did not attempt to memorize details. He had no intention of becoming an expert on Auroran society, nor even of passing a high school test on the subject. Rather, he wished to get the feel of it. He noticed, for instance, even through the hagiographic attitude of historians writing for young people, that the Auroran pioneers, the founding fathers, the Earth people who had first come to Aurora to settle in the early days of interstellar travel, had been very much Earth people. Their politics, their quarrels, every facet of their behavior had been Earthish. What happened on Aurora was, in ways, similar to the events that took place when the relatively empty sections of Earth had been settled a couple of thousand years before. Of course, the Aurorans had no intelligent life to encounter and to fight, no thinking organisms to puzzle the invaders from Earth with questions of treatment, humane or cruel. There was precious little life of any kind, in fact. So the planet was quickly settled by human beings, by their domesticated plants and animals, and by the parasites and other organisms that were adventitiously brought along. And, of course, the settlers brought robots with them. The first Aurorans quickly felt the planet to be theirs, since it fell into their laps with no sense of competition, and they had called the planet New Earth to begin with. That was natural, since it was the first extrasolar planet, the first spacer world, to be settled. It was the first fruit of interstellar travel, the first dawn of an immense new era. They quickly cut the umbilical cord, however, and renamed the planet Aurora, after the Roman goddess of the dawn. It was the world of the dawn. And so did the settlers from the start self-consciously declare themselves the progenitors of a new kind. All previous history of humanity was a dark night, and only for the Aurorans on this new world was the day finally approaching. It was this great fact, this great self-praise, that made itself felt over all the details, all the names, dates, winners, losers. It was the essential. Other worlds were settled, some from Earth, some from Aurora. But Bailey paid no attention to that or to any of the details. He was after the broad brush strokes, and he noted the two massive changes that took place and pushed the Aurorans ever farther away from their earthly origins. These were, first, the increasing integration of robots into every facet of life, and second, the extension of the lifespan. As the robots grew more advanced and versatile, the Aurorans grew more dependent on them, but never helplessly so. Not like the world of Solaria, Bailey remembered, on which a very few human beings were in the collective womb of very many robots. Aurora was not like that. And yet, they grew more dependent. Viewing, as he did for intuitive feel, for trend and generality, every step in the course of human-robot interaction seemed to depend on dependence. Even the manner in which a consensus of robotic rights was reached, the gradual dropping of what Daniil would call unnecessary distinctions, was a sign of the dependence. To Bailey, it seemed not that the Aurorans were growing more humane in their attitude out of a liking for the humane, but that they were denying the robotic nature of the objects in order to remove the discomfort of having to recognize the fact that human beings were dependent upon objects of artificial intelligence. As for the extended lifespan, that was accompanied by a slowing of the pace of history. The peaks and troughs smoothed out. There was a growing continuity and a growing consensus. There was no question but that the history he was viewing grew less interesting as it went along. It became almost soporific. For those living through it, this had to be good. History was interesting to the extent that it was catastrophic, and while that might make absorbing viewing, it made horrible living. Undoubtedly, personal lives continued to be interesting for the vast majority of Aurorans, and if the collective interaction of lives grew quiet, who would mind? If the world of the dawn had a quiet, sunlit day, who on that world would clamor for storm? Somewhere in the course of his viewing, Bailey felt an indescribable sensation. If he had been forced to attempt a description, he would have said it was that of a momentary inversion. It was as though he had been turned inside out, and then back as he had been, in the course of a small fraction of a second. So momentary had it been that he almost missed it, ignoring it as though it had been a tiny hiccup inside himself. It was only perhaps a minute later, suddenly going over the feeling in retrospect, that he remembered the sensation as something he had experienced twice before, once when traveling to Solaria, and once when returning to Earth from that planet. It was the jump, the passage through hyperspace that, in a timeless, spaceless interval, sent the ship across the parsecs and defeated the speed of light limit of the universe. No mystery in words, since the ship merely left the universe and traversed something which involved no speed limit. Total mystery in concept, however, for there was no way of describing what hyperspace was unless one made use of mathematical symbols which could in any case not be translated into anything comprehensible. If one accepted the fact that human beings had learned to manipulate hyperspace without understanding the thing they manipulated, then the effect was clear. At one moment the ship had been within microparsecs of Earth, and at the next moment it was within microparsecs of Aurora. Ideally, the jump took zero time, literally zero, and if it were carried through with perfect smoothness, there would not, could not be any biological sensation at all. Physicists maintained, however, that perfect smoothness required infinite energy, so that there was always an effective time that was not quite zero, though it could be made as short as desired. It was that which produced that odd and essentially harmless feeling of inversion. The sudden realization that he was very far from Earth and very close to Aurora filled Bailey with a desire to see the spacer world. Partly it was desire to see somewhere people lived. Partly it was a natural curiosity to see something that had been filling his thoughts as a result of the book films he had been viewing. Giscard entered just then with the middle meal between waking and sleeping, call it lunch, and said, "We are approaching Aurora, sir, but it will not be possible for you to observe it from the bridge. There would, in any case, be nothing to see. Aurora's sun is merely a bright star, and it will be several days before we are near enough to Aurora itself to see any detail." Then he added, as though an afterthought, "It will not be possible for you to observe it from the bridge at that time either." Bailey felt strangely abashed. Apparently it was assumed he would want to observe, and that want was simply squashed. His presence as a viewer was not desired. He said, "Very well, Giscard." And the robot left. Bailey looked after him, somberly. How many other constraints would be placed on him? Improbable as successful completion of his task was, he wondered in how many different ways Aurorans would conspire to make it impossible. Chapter 3. Giscard. 9. Bailey turned and said to Daniil, "It annoys me, Daniil, that I must remain a prisoner here because the Aurorans on board this ship fear me as a source of infection. This is pure superstition. I have been treated." Daniil said, "It is not because of Auroran fears that you are being asked to remain in your cabin, Partner Elijah." "No. What other reason?" "Perhaps you remember that when we first met on this ship, you asked me my reasons for being sent to escort you. I said it was to give you something familiar as an anchor and to please me. I was then about to tell you the third reason, when Giscard interrupted us with your viewer and viewing material, and thereafter we launched into a discussion of roboticide." "And you never told me the third reason. What is it?"
"Why, Partner Elijah, it is merely that I might help protect you."
"Against what?"
"Unusual passions have been stirred by the incident we have agreed to call roboticide. You are being called to Aurora to help demonstrate Dr. Fastolf's innocence, and the hyperwave drama..."
"Jehoshaphat, Daniil," said Bailey in outrage. "Have they seen that thing on Aurora, too?"
They have seen it throughout the spacer worlds, Partner Elijah. It was the most popular program, and has made it quite plain that you are a most extraordinary investigator.
So that whoever might be behind the roboticide may well have exaggerated fears of what I might accomplish and might therefore risk a great deal to prevent my arrival, or to kill me.
Dr. Fastoff, said Daniil calmly, is quite convinced that no one is behind the roboticide, since no human being other than himself could have carried it through. It was a purely fortuitous occurrence, in Dr. Fastoff's view. However, there are those who are trying to capitalize on the occurrence, and it would be to their interest to keep you from proving that. For that reason, you must be protected.
Bailey took a few hasty steps to one wall of the room, and then back to the other, as though to speed his thought processes by physical example. Somehow he did not feel any sense of personal danger. He said, Daniil, how many humaniform robots are there altogether on Aurora?
Do you mean now that Jander no longer functions?
Yes, now that Jander is dead.
One, Partner Elijah.
Bailey stared at Daniil in shock. Soundlessly, he mouthed the word. One? Finally, he said, let me understand this, Daniil. You are the only humaniform robot on Aurora?
Or on any world, Partner Elijah. I thought you were aware of this. I was the prototype, and then Jander was constructed. Since then, Dr. Fastoff has refused to construct any more, and no one else has the skill to do it.
But in that case, since of two humaniform robots, one has been killed, does it not occur to Dr. Fastoff that the remaining humaniform, you, Daniil, might be in danger?
He recognizes the possibility. But the chance that the fantastically unlikely occurrence of mental freeze-out would take place a second time is remote. He doesn't take it seriously. He feels, however, that there might be a chance of other misadventure. That, I think, played some small part in his sending me to Earth to get you. It kept me away from Aurora for a week or so.
And you are now as much a prisoner as I am, aren't you, Daniil?
I am a prisoner, said Daniil gravely. Only in the sense, Partner Elijah, that I am expected not to leave this room.
In what other sense is one a prisoner?
In the sense that the person so restricted in his movements resents the restriction. A true imprisonment has the implication of being involuntary. I quite understand the reason for being here, and I concur in the necessity.
You do, grumbled Bailey. I do not. I am a prisoner in the full sense. And what keeps us safe here, anyway?
For one thing, Partner Elijah, Giscard is on duty outside.
Is he intelligent enough for the job?
He understands his orders entirely. He is rugged and strong and quite realizes the importance of his task.
You mean he is prepared to be destroyed to protect the two of us?
Yes, of course, just as I am prepared to be destroyed to protect you.
Bailey felt abashed. He said, you do not resent the situation in which you may be forced to give up your existence for me?
It is my programming, Partner Elijah, said Daniil in a voice that seemed to soften. Yet somehow it seems to me that even were it not for my programming, saving you makes the loss of my own existence seem quite trivial in comparison.
Bailey could not resist this. He held out his hand and closed it on Daniil's with a fierce grip. Thank you, Partner Daniil. But please do not allow it to happen. I do not wish the loss of your existence. The preservation of my own would be inadequate compensation, it seems to me.
And Bailey was amazed to discover that he really meant it. He was faintly horrified to realize that he would be ready to risk his life for a robot. No, not for a robot, for Daniil.
10. Giscard entered without signaling. Bailey had come to accept that. The robot, as his guard, had to be able to come and go as he pleased, and Giscard was only a robot in Bailey's eyes, however much he might be a he and however much one did not mention the R. If Bailey were scratching himself, picking his nose, engaged in any messy biological function, it seemed to him that Giscard would be indifferent, non-judgmental, incapable of reacting in any way, but coldly recording the observation in some inner memory bank. It made Giscard simply a piece of mobile furniture,
and Bailey felt no embarrassment in his presence. Not that Giscard had ever intruded on him at an inconvenient moment, Bailey thought idly. Giscard brought a small cubicle with him.
Sir, I suspect that you still wish to observe Aurora from space.
Bailey started. No doubt Daniil had noted Bailey's irritation and had deduced its cause and taken this way of dealing with it. To have Giscard do it and present it as an idea of his simple-minded own was a touch of delicacy on Daniil's part. It would free Bailey of the necessity of expressing gratitude, or so Daniil would think. Bailey had, as a matter of fact, been more irritated at being, to his way of thinking, needlessly kept from the view of Aurora than at being kept in prison generally. He had been fretting over the loss of the view during the 2 days since the jump. So he turned and said to Daniil, "Thank you, my friend."
"It was Giscard's idea," said Daniil.
"Yes, of course," said Bailey with a small smile. "I thank him, too. What is this, Giscard?"
"It is an astro-simulator, sir. It works essentially like a trimensional receiver and is connected to the view room. If I might add..."
"Yes?"
"You will not find the view particularly exciting, sir. I would not wish you to be unnecessarily disappointed."
"I will try not to expect too much, Giscard. In any case, I will not hold you responsible for any disappointment I might feel."
"Thank you, sir. I must return to my post, but Daniil will be able to help you with the instrument if any problem arises."
He left, and Bailey turned to Daniil with approval. "Giscard handled that very well," I thought. "He may be a simple model, but he's well designed."
"He, too, is a fast-off robot, Partner Elijah. This astro-simulator is self-contained and self-adjusted. Since it is already focused on Aurora, it is only necessary to touch the control edge. That will put it in operation, and you need do nothing more. Would you care to set it going yourself?"
Bailey shrugged. "No need. You may do it."
"Very well."
Daniil had placed the cubicle upon the table on which Bailey had done his book film viewing. "This," he said, indicating a small rectangle in his hand, "is the control, Partner Elijah. You need only hold it by the edges in this manner, and then exert a small inward pressure to turn the mechanism on, and then another to turn it off." Daniil pressed the control edge, and Bailey shouted in a strangled way. Bailey had expected the cubicle to light up and to display within itself a holographic representation of a starfield. That was not what happened. Instead, Bailey found himself in space, with bright, unblinking stars in all directions. It lasted for only a moment, and then everything was back as it was. The room, and within it, Bailey, Daniil, and the cubicle.
"My regrets, Partner Elijah," said Daniil. "I turned it off as soon as I understood your discomfort. I did not realize you were not prepared for the event."
"Then prepare me. What happened?"
"The astro-simulator works directly on the visual center of the human brain. There is no way of distinguishing the impression it leaves from three-dimensional reality. It is a comparatively recent device, and so far it has been used only for astronomical scenes, which are, after all, low in detail."
"Did you see it too, Daniil?"
"Yes, but very poorly, and without the realism a human being experiences. I see the dim outline of a scene superimposed upon the still clear contents of the room. But it has been explained to me that human beings see the scene only. Undoubtedly, when the brains of those such as myself are still more finely tuned and adjusted..."
Bailey had recovered his equilibrium. "The point is, Daniil, that I was aware of nothing else. I was not aware of myself. I did not see my hands or sense where they were. I felt as though I were a disembodied spirit, or as I imagine, I would feel if I were dead but were consciously existing in some sort of immaterial afterlife."
"I see now why you would find that rather disturbing."
"Actually, I found it very disturbing."
"My regrets, Partner Elijah. I shall have Giscard take this away."
"No, I'm prepared now. Let me have that cube. Will I be able to turn it off even though I am not conscious of the existence of my hands?"
"It will cling to your hand so that you will not drop it, Partner Elijah. I have been told by Dr. Fastolf, who has experienced this phenomenon, that the pressure is automatically applied when the human being holding it wills an end.
It is an automatic phenomenon based on nerve manipulation, as the vision itself is. At least that is how it works with Aurorans, and I imagine that Earthmen are sufficiently similar to Aurorans physiologically for it to work with us as well. Very well, give me the control, and I will try. With a slight internal wince, Bailey squeezed the control edge and was in space again. He was expecting it this time, and once he found he could breathe without difficulty and did not feel in any way as though he were immersed in a vacuum, he labored to accept it all as a visual illusion. Breathing rather stertorously, perhaps to convince himself he was actually breathing, he stared about curiously in all directions. Suddenly aware he was hearing his breath rasp in his nose, he said, "Can you hear me, Daniil?" He heard his own voice, a little distant, a little artificial, but he heard it. And then he heard Daniil's, different enough to be distinguishable. "Yes, I can," said Daniil. "And you should be able to hear me, partner Elijah. The visual and kinesthetic senses are interfered with for the sake of a greater illusion of reality, but the auditory sense remains untouched, largely so at any rate." "Well, I see only stars, ordinary stars, that is. Aurora has a sun. We are close enough to Aurora, I imagine, to make the star that is its sun considerably brighter than the others."
"Entirely too bright, partner Elijah. It is blanked out, or you might suffer retinal damage."
"Then where is the planet Aurora?"
"Do you see the constellation of Orion?"
"Yes, I do. Do you mean we still see the constellations as we see them in Earth's sky, as in the city planetarium?"
"Just about. As stellar distances go, we are not far from Earth and the solar system, of which it is part,
so that they have the star view in common. Aurora's sun is known as Tau Ceti on Earth, and is only 3.67 parsecs from there. Now, if you'll imagine a line from Betelgeuse to the middle star of Orion's belt, and continue it for an equal length and a bit more, the middling bright star, you see, is actually the planet Aurora. It will become increasingly unmistakable over the next few days as we approach it rapidly." Bailey regarded it gravely. It was just a bright star-like object. There was no luminous arrow going on and off pointing to it. There was no carefully lettered inscription arced over it. He said, "Where's the sun? Earth star, I mean." "It's in the constellation Virgo, as seen from Aurora. It is a second magnitude star. Unfortunately, the astro simulator we have is not properly computerized, and it would not be easy to point it out to you. It would, in any case, just appear to be a star, quite an ordinary one."
"Never mind," said Bailey. "I'm going to turn off this thing now. If I have trouble, help out."
He didn't have trouble.
It flicked off just as he thought of doing so, and he sat blinking in the suddenly harsh light of the room. It was only then, when he had returned to his normal senses, that it occurred to him that for some minutes he had seemed to himself to have been out in space, without a protecting wall of any kind, and yet his earthly agoraphobia had not been activated. He had been perfectly comfortable once he had accepted his own non-existence. The thought puzzled him and distracted him from his book film viewing for a while. Periodically, he returned to the astro simulator and took another look at space as seen from a vantage point just outside the spaceship, with himself nowhere present, apparently. Sometimes it was just for a moment to reassure himself that he was still not made uneasy by the infinite void. Sometimes he found himself lost in the pattern of the stars, and he began lazily counting them or forming geometrical figures, rather luxuriating in the ability to do something which on Earth he would never have been able to do because the mounting agoraphobic uneasiness would quickly have overwhelmed everything else. Eventually, it grew quite obvious that Aurora was brightening. It soon became easy to detect among the other dots of light, then unmistakable, and finally unavoidable. It began as a tiny sliver of light, and thereafter it enlarged rapidly and began to show phases. It was almost precisely a half-circle of light when Bailey became aware of the existence of phases. Bailey inquired, and Daniil said, "We are approaching from outside the orbital plane, partner Elijah. Aurora's south pole is more or less in the center of its disk, somewhat into the lighted half. It is spring in the southern hemisphere." Bailey said,
According to the material I have been reading, Aurora's axis is tipped 16 degrees. He had glanced over the physical description of the planet with insufficient attention in his anxiety to get to the Aurorans, but he remembered that.
Yes, partner Elijah. Eventually, we will move into orbit about Aurora, and the phases will then change rapidly. Aurora revolves more rapidly than Earth does.
It has a 22-hour day, yes.
A day of 22.3 traditional hours. The Auroran day is divided into 10 Auroran hours, with each hour divided into 100 Auroran minutes, which are in turn divided into 100 Auroran seconds. An Auroran second is thus roughly equal to 0.8 Earth seconds.
Is that what the books mean when they refer to metric hours, metric minutes, and so on?
Yes. It was difficult to persuade the Aurorans at first to abandon the time units to which they were accustomed, and both systems, the standard and the metric, were in use. Eventually, of course, the metric won out. At present, we speak only of hours, minutes, and seconds, but the decimalized versions are invariably meant. The same system has been adopted throughout the spacer worlds, even though on the other worlds, it does not tie in with the natural rotation of the planet. Each planet also uses a local system, of course.
As Earth does.
Yes, partner Elijah, but Earth uses only the original standard time units. That inconveniences the spacer worlds where trade is concerned, but they allow Earth to go its way in this.
Not out of friendliness, I imagine. I suspect they wish to emphasize Earth's difference. How does decimalization fit in with the year? After all, Aurora must have a natural period of revolution about its sun that controls the cycle of its seasons. How is that measured?
Daniil said, Aurora revolves about its sun in 373.5 Auroran days, or in about 0.95 Earth years. That is not considered a vital matter in chronology. Aurora accepts 30 of its days as equaling a month, and 10 months as equaling a metric year. The metric year is equal to about 0.8 seasonal years, or about three-quarters of an Earth year. The relationship is different on each world, of course. 10 days is usually referred to as a decimonth. All the spacer worlds use this system.
Surely there must be some convenient way of following the cycle of the seasons.
Each world has its seasonal year, too, but it is little regarded. One can, by computer, convert any day, past or present, into its position in the seasonal year, if for any reason such information is desired. And this is true on any world where conversion to and from the local days is also as easily possible. And, of course, partner Elijah, any robot can do the same, and can guide human activity where the seasonal year or local time is relevant. The advantage of metricized units is that it supplies humanity with a unified chronometry that involves little more than decimal point shifts. It bothered Bailey that the books he viewed made none of this clear, but then from his own knowledge of Earth's history, he knew that at one time the lunar month had been the key to the calendar, and that there had come a time when, for ease of chronometry, the lunar month came to be ignored and was never missed. Yet, if he had given books on Earth to some stranger, that stranger would have very likely found no mention of the lunar month or any historical change in calendars. Dates would have been given without explanation. What else would be given without explanation? How far could he rely, then, on the knowledge he was gaining? He would have to ask questions constantly, take nothing for granted. There would be so many opportunities to miss the obvious, so many chances to misunderstand, so many ways of taking the wrong path. 11. Aurora filled his vision now when he used the astro-simulator, and it looked like Earth. Bailey had never seen Earth in the same way, but there had been photographs in astronomy texts, and he had seen those. Well, what Bailey saw on Aurora were the same cloud patterns, the same glimpse of desert areas, the same large stretches of day and night, and the same pattern of twinkling light in the expanse of the night hemisphere as the photographs showed on Earth's globe. Bailey watched raptly and thought, what if, for some reason, he had been taken into space, told he was being brought to Aurora, and was in reality being returned to Earth for some reason, for some subtle and insane reason? How could he tell the difference before landing? Was there reason to be suspicious? Daniil had carefully told him that the constellations were the same in the sky of both planets. But wouldn't that be naturally so for planets circling neighboring stars?
The gross appearance of both planets from space was identical. But wouldn't that be expected if both were habitable and comfortably suited to human life? Was there any reason to suppose such a far-fetched deception would be played upon him? What purpose would it serve? And yet why shouldn't it be made to appear far-fetched and useless? If there were an obvious reason to do such a thing, he would have seen through it at once. Would Daniil be party to such a conspiracy? Surely not, if he were a human being, but he was only a robot. Might there not be a way to order him to behave appropriately? There was no way of coming to a decision. Bailey found himself watching for glimpses of continental outlines that he could recognize as earthly or as non-earthly. That would be the telling test. Except that it didn't work. The glimpses that came and went hazily through the clouds were of no use to him. He was not sufficiently knowledgeable about Earth's geography. What he really knew of Earth were its underground cities, its caves of steel. The bits of coastline he saw were unfamiliar to him. Whether Aurora or Earth, he did not know. Why this uncertainty, anyway? When he had gone to Solaria, he had never doubted his destination. He had never suspected that they might be bringing him back to Earth. Ah, but then he had gone on a clear-cut mission in which there was reasonable chance for success. Now he felt there was no chance at all. Perhaps it was then that he wanted to be returned to Earth and was building a false conspiracy in his mind so that he could imagine it possible. The uncertainty in his mind had come to have a life of its own. He couldn't let go. He found himself watching Aurora with an almost mad intensity, unable to come back to the cabin reality. Aurora was moving, turning slowly. He had watched long enough to see that. While he had been viewing space, everything had seemed motionless, like a painted backdrop, a silent and static pattern of dots of light, with, later on, a small half-circle included. Was it the motionlessness that enabled him to be non-agoraphobic? But now he could see Aurora moving, and he realized that the ship was spiraling down in the final stage before landing. The clouds were bellying upward. No, not the clouds. The ship was spiraling downward. The ship was moving. He was moving. He was suddenly aware of his own existence. He was hurtling downward through the clouds. He was falling, unguarded, through thin air toward solid ground. His throat constricted. It was becoming very hard to breathe. He told himself desperately, "You are enclosed. The walls of the ship are around you." But he sensed no walls. He thought, "Even without considering the walls, you are still enclosed. You are wrapped in skin." But he sensed no skin. The sensation was worse than simple nakedness. He was an unaccompanied personality, the essence of identity totally uncovered, a living point, a singularity surrounded by an open and infinite world, and he was falling. He wanted to close off the vision, contract his fist upon the control edge, but nothing happened. His nerve endings had so abnormalized that the automatic contraction at an effort of will did not work. He had no will. Eyes would not close. Fist would not contract. He was caught and hypnotized by terror, frightened into immobility. All he sensed before him were clouds, white, not quite white, off-white, a slight golden orange cast, and all turned to gray, and he was drowning. He could not breathe. He struggled desperately to open his clogged throat to call to Daniil for help. He could make no sound. 12. Bailey was breathing as though he had just breasted the tape at the end of a long race. The room was askew, and there was a hard surface under his left elbow. He realized he was on the floor. Giscard was on his knees beside him, his robot's hand, firm but somewhat cold, closed on Bailey's right fist. The door to the cabin, visible to Bailey just beyond Giscard's shoulder, stood ajar. Bailey knew, without asking, what had happened. Giscard had seized that helpless human hand and clenched it upon the control edge to end the astro-simulation. Otherwise, Daniil was there as well, his face close to Bailey's, with a look on it that might well have been pain. He said, "You said nothing, partner Elijah. Had I been more quickly aware of your discomfort..." Bailey tried a gesture that he understood, that it did not matter. He was still unable to speak. The two robots waited until Bailey made a feeble movement to get up. Arms were under him at once, lifting him. He was placed in a chair, and the control was gently taken away from him by Giscard. Giscard said, "We will be landing soon. You will have no further need of the astro-simulator, I believe." Daniil added gravely, "It would be best to remove it in any case." Bailey said, "Wait." His voice was a hoarse whisper, and he was not sure the word could be made out. He drew a deep breath, cleared his throat feebly, and said again, "Wait." And then, "Giscard." Giscard turned back. "Sir?" Bailey did not speak at once. Now that Giscard knew he was wanted, he would wait a lengthy interval, perhaps indefinitely. Bailey tried to gather his scattered wits. Agoraphobia or not, there still remained his uncertainty about their destination. That had existed first, and it might well have intensified the agoraphobia. He had to find out. Giscard would not lie. A robot could not lie, unless very carefully instructed to do so. And why instruct Giscard? It was Daniil who was his companion, who was to be in his company at all times. If there was lying to be done, that would be Daniil's job. Giscard was merely a fetcher and carrier, a guard at the door. Surely there was no need to undergo the task of carefully instructing him in the web of lies. "Giscard," said Bailey, almost normally now.
"Sir?"
"We are about to land, are we?"
"In a little less than 2 hours, sir."
That was 2 metric hours, thought Bailey. More than 2 real hours, less. It didn't matter. It would only confuse. Forget it. Bailey said as sharply as he could manage, "Tell me right now the name of the planet we are about to land on."
A human being, if he had answered at all, would have done so only after a pause, and then with an air of considerable surprise. Giscard answered at once, with a flat and uninflected assertion, "It is Aurora, sir."
"How do you know?"
"It is our destination. Then, too, it could not be Earth, for instance, since Aurora's sun, Tau Ceti, is only 90% the mass of Earth's sun. Tau Ceti is a little cooler, therefore, and its light has a distinct orange tinge to fresh and unaccustomed Earth eyes. You may have already seen the characteristic color of Aurora's sun in the reflection upon the upper surface of the cloud bank. You will certainly see it in the appearance of the landscape until your eyes grow accustomed to it." Bailey's eyes left Giscard's impassive face. He had noticed the color difference, Bailey thought, and had attached no importance to it. A bad error.
"You may go, Giscard."
"Yes, sir."
Bailey turned bitterly to Daniil. "I've made a fool of myself, Daniil."
"I gather you wondered if perhaps we were deceiving you and taking you somewhere that was not Aurora. Did you have a reason for suspecting this, Partner Elijah?"
"None. It may have been the result of the uneasiness that rose from subliminal agoraphobia. Staring at seemingly motionless space, I felt no perceptible illness. But it may have lain just under the surface, creating a gathering uneasiness."
"The fault was ours, Partner Elijah. Knowing of your dislike for open spaces, it was wrong to subject you to astro-simulation, or having done so, to subject you to no closer supervision."
Bailey shook his head in annoyance. "Don't say that, Daniil. I have supervision enough. The question in my mind is how closely I am to be supervised on Aurora itself."
Daniil said, "Partner Elijah, it seems to me it will be difficult to allow you free access to Aurora and Aurorans."
"That is just what I must be allowed, nevertheless. If I'm to get to the truth of this case of roboticide, I must be free to seek information directly on the site and from the people involved."
Bailey was by now feeling quite himself, though a bit weary. Embarrassingly enough, the intense experience he had passed through left him with a keen desire for a pipe of tobacco, something he thought he had done away with altogether better than a year before. He could feel the taste and odor of the tobacco smoke making its way through his throat and nose. He would, he knew, have to make do with the memory. On Aurora, he would on no account be allowed to smoke. There was no tobacco on any of the spacer worlds, and if he had had any on him to begin with, it would have been removed and destroyed. Daniil said, "Partner Elijah, this must be discussed with Dr. Fastolf once we land. I have no power to make any decisions in this matter."
"I'm aware of that, Daniil, but how do I speak to Fastolf? Through the equivalent of an astro-simulator? With controls in my hand?"
"Not at all, Partner Elijah. You will speak face to face. He plans to meet you at the spaceport."
13. Bailey listened for the noises of landing. He did not know what they might be, of course. He did not know the mechanism of the ship, how many men and women it carried, what they would have to do in the process of landing, what in the way of noise would be involved. Shouts? Rumbles? A dim vibration?
He heard nothing.
Daniil said,
"You seem to be under tension, Partner Elijah."
I would prefer that you did not wait to tell me of any discomfort you might feel. I must help you at the very moment you are, for any reason, unhappy. There was a faint stress on the word must. Bailey thought absently. The first law drives him. He surely suffered as much in his way as I suffered in mine when I collapsed and he did not foresee it in time. A forbidden imbalance of positronic potentials may have no meaning to me, but it may produce in him the same discomfort and the same reaction as acute pain would to me. He thought further. How can I tell what exists inside the pseudo-skin and pseudo-consciousness of a robot any more than Daniil can tell what exists inside me? And then, feeling remorse at having thought of Daniil as a robot, Bailey looked into the other's gentle eyes. When did he start thinking of their expression as gentle? And said, I would tell you of any discomfort at once. There is none. I am merely trying to hear any noise that might tell me of the progress of the landing procedure, Partner Daniil. Thank you, Partner Elijah, said Daniil gravely. He bowed his head slightly and went on. There should be no discomfort in the landing. You will feel acceleration, but that will be minimal, for this room will yield, to a certain extent, in the direction of the acceleration. The temperature may go up, but not more than 2 degrees Celsius. As for sonic effects, there may be a low hiss as we pass through the thickening atmosphere. Will any of this disturb you? It shouldn't. What does disturb me is not being free to participate in the landing. I would like to know about such things. I do not want to be imprisoned and to be kept from the experience. You have already discovered, Partner Elijah, that the nature of the experience does not suit your temperament. And how am I to get over that, Daniil? He said strenuously. That is not enough reason to keep me here. Partner Elijah, I have already explained that you are kept here for your own safety. Bailey shook his head in clear disgust. I have thought of that, and I say it's nonsense. My chances of straightening out this mess are so small, with all the restrictions being placed on me, and with the difficulty I will have in understanding anything about Aurora, that I don't think anyone in his right mind would bother to take the trouble to try to stop me. And if they did, why bother attacking me personally? Why not sabotage the ship? If we imagine ourselves to be facing no-holds-barred villains, they should find a ship, and the people aboard it, and you and Giscard, and myself, of course, to be a small price to pay. This has, in point of fact, been considered, Partner Elijah. The ship has been carefully studied. Any signs of sabotage would be detected. Are you sure, 100% certain? Nothing of this sort can be absolutely certain. Giscard and I were comfortable, however, with the thought that the certainty was quite high, and that we might proceed with minimal expectation of disaster. And if you were wrong? Something like a small sign of spasm crossed Daniil's face, as though he were being asked to consider something that interfered with the smooth working of the positronic pathways in his brain. He said, But we have not been wrong. You cannot say that. We are approaching the landing, and that is sure to be the danger moment. In fact, at this point, there is no need to sabotage the ship. My personal danger is greatest now, right now. I can't hide in this room if I'm to disembark at Aurora. I will have to pass through the ship and be within reach of others. Have you taken precautions to keep the landing safe? He was being petty, striking out at Daniil needlessly because he was chafing at his long imprisonment and at the indignity of his moment of collapse. But Daniil said calmly, We have, Partner Elijah. And incidentally, we have landed. We are now resting on the surface of Aurora. For a moment, Bailey was bewildered. He looked around wildly, but of course there was nothing to see but an enclosing room. He had felt and heard nothing of what Daniil had described. None of the acceleration, or heat, or wind whistle. Or had Daniil deliberately brought up the matter of his personal danger once again, in order to make sure he would not think of other unsettling but minor matters? Bailey said, And yet there's still the matter of getting off the ship. How do I do that without being vulnerable to possible enemies? Daniil walked to one wall and touched a spot upon it. The wall promptly split in two, the two halves moving apart. Bailey found himself looking into a long cylinder, a tunnel. Giscard had entered the room at that moment from the other side and said, Sir, the three of us will move through the exit tube. Others have it under observation from without. At the other end of the tube, Dr. Fastolf is waiting. We have taken every precaution, said Daniil. Bailey muttered, My apologies, Daniil, Giscard. He moved into the exit tube somberly. Every effort to assure that precautions had been taken also assured him that those precautions were thought necessary. Bailey liked to think he was no coward, but he was on a strange planet, with no way of telling friend from enemy, with no way of taking comfort in anything familiar, except, of course, Daniil. At crucial moments, he thought with a shiver, he would be without enclosure to warm him and to give him relief. Chapter 4. Fastolf. 14. Dr. Han Fastolf was indeed waiting and smiling. He was tall and thin, with light brown hair that was not very thick, and there were, of course, his ears. It was the ears that Bailey remembered, even after 3 years. Large ears standing away from his head, giving him a vaguely humorous appearance, a pleasant homeliness. It was the ears that made Bailey smile, rather than Fastolf's welcome. Bailey wondered briefly if Auroran medical technology did not extend to the minor plastic surgery required to correct the ungainliness of those ears. But then it might well be that Fastolf liked their appearance, as Bailey himself, rather to his surprise, did. There is something to be said about a face that makes one smile. Perhaps Fastolf valued being liked at first glance. Or was it that he found it useful to be underestimated? Or just different? Fastolf said, "Plainclothesman Elijah Bailey, I remember you well, even though I persist in thinking of you as possessing the face of the actor who portrayed you." Bailey's face turned grim. "That hyperwave dramatization haunts me, Dr. Fastolf. If I knew where I could go to escape it."
"Nowhere," said Fastolf genially. "At least ordinarily. So if you don't like it, we'll expunge it from our conversations right now. I shall never mention it again. Agreed?"
"Thank you." With calculated suddenness, he thrust out his hand at Fastolf. Fastolf hesitated perceptibly. Then he took Bailey's hand, holding it gingerly, and not for long, and said,
"I shall assume you are not a walking sack of infection, Mr. Bailey."
Then he said ruefully, staring at his hands,
"I must admit, though, that my hands have been treated with an inert film that doesn't feel entirely comfortable. I am a creature of the irrational fears of my society."
Bailey shrugged. "So are we all. I do not relish the thought of being outside, in the open air, that is. For that matter, I do not relish having had to come to Aurora under the circumstances in which I find myself."
"I understand that well, Mr. Bailey. I have a closed car for you here, and when we come to my establishment, we will do our best to continue to keep you enclosed."
"Thank you. But in the course of my stay on Aurora, I feel that it will be necessary for me to stay outside on occasion. I am prepared for that, as best I can be."
"I understand, but we will inflict the outside on you only when it is necessary. That is not now the case, so please consent to be enclosed."
The car was waiting in the shadow of the tunnel, and there would scarcely be a trace of outside in passing from the latter to the former. Behind him, Bailey was aware of both Daniil and Gascard, quite dissimilar in appearance, but both identical in grave and waiting attitude, and both endlessly patient. Fastolf opened the back door and said,
"Please to get in."
Bailey entered. Quickly and smoothly, Daniil entered behind him, while Gascard, virtually simultaneously, in what seemed almost like a well-choreographed dance movement, entered on the other side. Bailey found himself wedged, but not oppressively so, between them. In fact, he welcomed the thought that between himself and the outside, on both sides, was the thickness of a robotic body. But there was no outside. Fastolf climbed into the front seat, and as the door closed behind him, the windows blanked out, and a soft artificial light suffused the interior. Fastolf said,
"I don't generally drive this way, Mr. Bailey, but I don't mind a great deal, and you may find it more comfortable. The car is completely computerized, knows where it's going, and can deal with any obstructions or emergencies. We need interfere in no way."
There was the faintest feeling of acceleration, and then a vague, barely noticeable sensation of motion.
Fastolf said, "This is a secure passage, Mr. Bailey. I have gone to considerable trouble to make certain that as few people as possible know you will be in this car, and certainly you will not be detected within it. The trip by car, which rides on air jets, by the way, so that it is an airfoil, actually, will not take long, but if you wish, you can seize the opportunity to rest. You are quite safe now."
"You speak," said Bailey, "as though you think I'm in danger. I was protected to the point of imprisonment on the ship, and again now." Bailey looked about the small, enclosed interior of the car, within which he was hemmed by the frame of metal and opacified glass, to say nothing of the metallic frame of two robots. Fastolf laughed lightly.
"I am overreacting, I know, but feeling runs high on Aurora. You arrive here at a time of crisis for us, and I would rather be made to look silly by overreacting than to run the terrible risk that underreacting entails.
Bailey said, I believe you understand, Dr. Fastolf, that my failure here would be a blow to Earth.
I understand that well. I am as determined as you are to prevent your failure, believe me.
I do. Furthermore, my failure here, for whatever reason, will also be my personal and professional ruin on Earth.
Fastolf turned in his seat to look at Bailey with a shocked expression.
Really? That would not be warranted.
Bailey shrugged.
I agree, but it will happen. I will be the obvious target for a desperate Earth government.
That was not in my mind when I asked for you, Mr. Bailey. You may be sure I will do what I can, though in all honesty...
His eyes fell away.
That will be a little enough if we lose.
I know that, said Bailey, dourly.
He leaned back against the soft upholstery and closed his eyes. The motion of the car was limited to a gentle, lulling sway. But Bailey did not sleep. Instead, he thought hard for what that was worth.
15.
Bailey did not experience the outside at the other end of the trip, either. When he emerged from the airfoil, he was in an underground garage, and a small elevator brought him up to ground level, as it turned out. He was ushered into a sunny room, and as he passed through the direct rays of the sun, yes, faintly orange, he shrank away a bit. Fastolf noticed. He said,
The windows are not opacifiable, though they can be darkened. I will do that, if you like. In fact, I should have thought of that.
No need, said Bailey gruffly. I'll just sit with my back to it. I must acclimate myself.
If you wish, but let me know if at any time you grow too uncomfortable. Mr. Bailey, it is late morning here on this part of Aurora. I don't know your personal time on the ship. If you have been awake for many hours and would like to sleep, that can be arranged. If you are wakeful but not hungry, you need not eat. However, if you feel you can manage it, you are welcome to have lunch with me in a short while.
That would fit in well with my personal time, as it happens.
Excellent. I'll remind you that our day is about 7% shorter than Earth's. It shouldn't involve you in too much biorhythmic difficulties, but if it does, we will try to adjust ourselves to your needs.
Thank you.
Finally, I have no clear idea what your food preferences might be.
I'll manage to eat whatever is put before me.
Nevertheless, I won't feel offended if anything seems not palatable.
Thank you.
And you won't mind if Daniil and Giscard join us, too?
Bailey smiled faintly. Will they be eating, too?
There was no answering smile from Fastolf. He said seriously,
No, but I want them to be with you at all times.
Still danger, even here?
I trust nothing entirely, even here.
A robot entered. Sir, lunch is served. Fastolf nodded.
Very good, Faber. We will be at the table in a few moments.
Bailey said, How many robots do you have?
Quite a few. We are not at the Solarian level of 10,000 robots to a human being, but I have more than the average number, 57. The house is a large one, and it serves as my office and my workshop as well. Then, too, my wife, when I have one, must have space enough to be insulated from my work in a separate wing and must be served independently.
Well, with 57 robots, I imagine you can spare two. I feel the less guilty at your having sent Giscard and Daniil to escort me to Aurora.
It was no casual choice, I assure you, Mr. Bailey. Giscard is my majordomo in my right hand. He has been with me all my adult life.
Yet you sent him on the trip to get me. I am honored, said Bailey.
It is a measure of your importance, Mr. Bailey. Giscard is the most reliable of my robots, strong and sturdy.
Bailey's eye flickered toward Daniil, and Fastolf added,
I don't include my friend Daniil in these calculations. He is not my servant, but an achievement of which I have the weakness to be extremely proud. He is the first of his class, and while Dr. Raj Nemena Sartan was his designer and model, the man who...
He paused delicately, but Bailey nodded brusquely and said, I understand. He did not require the phrase to be completed with a reference to Sartan's murder on Earth.
While Sartan supervised the actual construction, Fastolf went on, it was I whose theoretical calculations made Daniil possible.
Fastolf smiled at Daniil, who bowed his head in acknowledgement.
Bailey said, There was Jander, too.
Yes.
Fastolf shook his head and looked downcast.
I should perhaps have kept him with me as I do Daniil. but he was my second humaniform, and that makes a difference. It is Daniil who is my firstborn, so to speak, a special case.
And you construct no more humaniform robots now?
No more. But come, said Fastolf, rubbing his hands. We must have our lunch. I do not think, Mr. Bailey, that on Earth the population is accustomed to what I might term natural food. We are having shrimp salad, together with bread and cheese, milk, if you wish, or any of an assortment of fruit juices. It's all very simple. Ice cream for dessert.
All traditional Earth dishes, said Bailey, which exist now in their original form only in Earth's ancient literature.
None of it is entirely common here on Aurora, but I didn't think it made sense to subject you to our own version of gourmet dining, which involves food items and spices of Auroran varieties. The taste would have to be acquired. He rose. Please come with me, Mr. Bailey. There will just be the two of us, and we will not stand on ceremony or indulge in unnecessary dining ritual.
Thank you, said Bailey. I accept that as a kindness. I have relieved the tedium of the trip here by a rather intensive viewing of material relating to Aurora, and I know that proper politeness requires many aspects to a ceremonial meal that I would dread.
You need not dread, Bailey said.
Could we break ceremony even to the extent of talking business over the meal, Dr. Fastolf? I must not lose time unnecessarily.
I sympathize with that point of view. We will indeed talk business, and I imagine I can rely on you to say nothing to anyone concerning that lapse. I would not want to be expelled from polite society.
He chuckled, then said,
Though I should not laugh, it is nothing to laugh at. Losing time may be more than inconvenience alone. It could easily be fatal.
16. The room that Bailey left was a spare one. Several chairs, a chest of drawers, something that looked like a piano but had brass valves in the place of keys, some abstract designs on the walls that seemed to shimmer with light. The floor was a smooth checkerboard of several shades of brown, perhaps designed to be reminiscent of wood, and although it shone with highlights as though freshly waxed, it did not feel slippery underfoot. The dining room, though it had the same floor, was like it in no other way. It was a long, rectangular room, overburdened with decoration. It contained six large square tables that were clearly modules that could be assembled in various fashions. A bar was to be found along one short wall, with gleaming bottles of various colors standing before a curved mirror that seemed to lend a nearly infinite extension to the room it reflected. Along the other short wall were four recesses, in each of which a robot waited. Both long walls were mosaics, in which the colors slowly changed. One was a planetary scene, though Bailey could not tell if it were Aurora or another planet or something completely imaginary. At one end there was a wheat field, or something of that sort, filled with elaborate farm machinery, all robot-controlled. As one's eye traveled along the length of the wall, that gave way to scattered human habitations, becoming at the other end what Bailey felt to be the Auroran version of a city. The other long wall was astronomical. A planet, blue-white, lit by a distant sun, reflected light in such a manner that not the closest examination could free one from the thought that it was slowly rotating. The stars that surrounded it, some faint, some bright, seemed also to be changing their patterns, though when the eye concentrated on some small grouping and remained fixed there, the stars seemed immobile. Bailey found it all confusing and repellent. Fastolf said,
Rather a work of art, Mr. Bailey. Far too expensive to be worth it, though, but Fanya would have it. Fanya is my current partner.
Will she be joining us, Dr. Fastolf?
No, Mr. Bailey. As I said, just the two of us. For the duration, I have asked her to remain in her own quarters. I do not want to subject her to this problem we have. You understand, I hope?
Yes, of course.
Come, please take your seat.
One of the tables was set with dishes, cups, and elaborate cutlery, not all of which were familiar to Bailey. In the center was a tall, somewhat tapering cylinder that looked as though it might be a gigantic chess pawn made out of a gray, rocky material. Bailey, as he sat down, could not resist reaching toward it and touching it with a finger. Fastolf smiled.
It's a spicer. It possesses simple controls that allows one to use it to deliver a fixed amount of any of a dozen different condiments on any portion of a dish. To do it properly, one picks it up and performs rather intricate evolutions that are meaningless in themselves, but that are much valued by fashionable Aurorans as symbols of the grace and delicacy with which meals should be served. When I was younger, I could, with my thumb and two fingers, do the triple genuflection and produce salt as the spicer struck my palm. Now if I tried it, I'd run a good risk of braining my guest. I trust you won't mind if I do not try.
I urge you not to try, Dr. Fastolf.
A robot placed the salad on the table. Another brought a tray of fruit juices. A third brought the bread and cheese. A fourth adjusted the napkins. All four operated in close coordination, weaving in and out without collision or any sign of difficulty. Bailey watched them in astonishment. They ended without any apparent sign of prearrangements, one at each side of the table. They stepped back in unison, bowed in unison, turned in unison, and returned to the recesses along the wall at the far end of the room. Bailey was suddenly aware of Daniil and Giscard in the room as well. He had not seen them come in. They waited in two recesses that had somehow appeared along the wall with the wheat field. Daniil was the closer. Fastolf said,
"Now that they've gone..."
He paused and shook his head slowly in rueful conclusion.
"Except that they haven't. Ordinarily, it is customary for the robots to leave before lunch actually begins. Robots do not eat, while human beings do. It therefore makes sense that those who eat do so, and that those who do not leave. And it has ended by becoming one more ritual. It would be quite unthinkable to eat until the robots left. In this case, though..."
"They have not left," said Bailey.
"No. I felt that security came before etiquette, and I felt that, not being an Auroran, you would not mind."
Bailey waited for Fastolf to make the first move. Fastolf lifted a fork, so did Bailey. Fastolf made use of it, moving slowly, and allowing Bailey to see exactly what he was doing. Bailey bit cautiously into a shrimp and found it delightful. He recognized the taste, which was like the shrimp paste produced on Earth, but enormously more subtle and rich. He chewed slowly, and for a while, despite his anxiety to get on with the investigation while dining, he found it quite unthinkable to do anything but give his full attention to the lunch. It was, in fact, Fastolf who made the first move.
"Shouldn't we make a beginning on the problem, Mr. Bailey?"
Bailey felt himself flush slightly.
"Yes, by all means. I ask your pardon. Your Auroran food caught me by surprise, so that it was difficult for me to think of anything else. The problem, Dr. Fastolf, is of your making, isn't it?"
"Why do you say that?"
"Someone has committed roboticide in a manner that requires great expertise, as I have been told."
"Roboticide? An amusing term."
Fastolf smiled.
"Of course, I understand what you mean by it. You have been told correctly. The manner requires enormous expertise."
"And only you have the expertise to carry it out, as I have been told."
"You have been told correctly there, too."
"And even you yourself admit, in fact you insist, that only you could have put Jander into a mental freeze-out."
"I maintain what is, after all, the truth, Mr. Bailey. It would do me no good to lie, even if I could bring myself to do so. It is notorious that I am the outstanding theoretical roboticist in all the 50 worlds."
"Nevertheless, Dr. Fastolf, might not the second-best theoretical roboticist in all the worlds, or the third-best, or even the 15th-best, nevertheless possess the necessary ability to commit the deed? Does it really require all the ability of the very best?"
Fastolf said calmly,
"In my opinion, it really requires all the ability of the very best. Indeed, again, in my opinion, I myself could only accomplish the task on one of my good days. Remember that the best brains in robotics, including mine, have specifically labored to design positronic brains that could not be driven into mental freeze-out."
"Are you certain of all that? Really certain?"
"Completely."
"And you stated so publicly?"
"Of course. There was a public inquiry, my dear Earthman. I was asked the questions you are now asking, and I answered truthfully. It is an Auroran custom to do so."
Bailey said, "I do not at the moment question that you were convinced you were answering truthfully, but might you not have been swayed by a natural pride in yourself? That might also be typically Auroran, might it not?"
"You mean that my anxiety to be considered the best would make me willingly put myself in a position where everyone would be forced to conclude I had mentally frozen Jander?"
"I picture you, somehow, as content to have your political and social status destroyed, provided your scientific reputation remained intact."
"I see. You have an interesting way of thinking, Mr. Bailey. This would not have occurred to me." Given a choice between admitting I was second best and admitting I was guilty of, to use your phrase, a roboticide, you are of the opinion I would knowingly accept the latter.
No, Dr. Fastolf, I do not wish to present the matter quite so simplistically. Might it not be that you deceive yourself into thinking you are the greatest of all roboticists and that you are completely unrivaled, clinging to that at all costs, because you unconsciously, Dr. Fastolf, realize that in fact you are being overtaken, or have even already been overtaken, by others.
Fastolf laughed, but there was an edge of annoyance in it. Not so, Mr. Bailey, quite wrong.
Think, Dr. Fastolf. Are you certain that none of your roboticist colleagues can approach you in brilliance?
There are only a few who are capable of dealing at all with humaniform robots. Daniil's construction created virtually a new profession for which there is not even a name. Humaniformicists, perhaps. Of the theoretical roboticists on Aurora, not one, except for myself, understands the workings of Daniil's positronic brain. Dr. Sarton did, but he is dead, and he did not understand it as well as I do. The basic theory is mine.
It may have been yours to begin with, but surely you can't expect to maintain exclusive ownership. Has no one learned the theory?
Fastolf shook his head firmly. Not one. I have taught no one, and I defy any other living roboticist to have developed the theory on his own.
Bailey said with a touch of irritation, Might there not be a bright young man fresh out of the university who is cleverer than anyone yet realizes, who...
No, Mr. Bailey, no. I would have known such a young man. He would have passed through my laboratories. He would have worked with me. At the moment, no such young man exists. Eventually one will, perhaps many will. At the moment, none.
If you died then, the new science dies with you?
I am only 165 years old. That's metric years, of course. So it is only 124 of your Earth years, more or less. I am still quite young by Auroran standards, and there is no medical reason why my life should be considered even half over. It is not entirely unusual to reach an age of 400 years, metric years. There is yet plenty of time to teach.
They had finished eating, but neither man made any move to leave the table, nor did any robot approach to clear it. It was as though they were transfixed into immobility by the intensity of the back-and-forth flow of talk. Bailey's eyes narrowed. He said, Dr. Fastolf, 2 years ago I was on Solaria. There I was given the clear impression that the Solarians were, on the whole, the most skilled roboticists in all the worlds.
On the whole, that's probably true.
And not one of them could have done the deed?
Not one, Mr. Bailey. Their skill is with robots who are, at best, no more advanced than my poor, reliable Giscard. The Solarians know nothing of the construction of humaniform robots.
How can you be sure of that?
Since you were on Solaria, Mr. Bailey, you know very well that Solarians can approach each other with only the greatest of difficulty, that they interact by trimensional viewing, except where sexual contact is absolutely required. Do you think that any of them would dream of designing a robot so human in appearance that it would activate their neuroses? They would so avoid the possibility of approaching him, since he would look so human, that they could make no reasonable use of him.
Might not a Solarian here or there display a surprising tolerance for the human body? How can you be sure?
Even if a Solarian could, which I do not deny, there are no Solarian nationals on Aurora this year.
None?
None. They do not like to be thrown into contact, even with Aurorans, and except on the most urgent business, none will come here, or to any other world. Even in the case of urgent business, they will come no closer than orbit, and then they deal with us only by electronic communication.
Bailey said, In that case, if you are, literally and actually, the only person in all the worlds who could have done it, did you kill Jander?
Fastolf said, I cannot believe that Daniil did not tell you I have denied this deed.
He did tell me so, but I want to hear it from you.
Fastolf crossed his arms and frowned. He said through clenched teeth, Then I'll tell you so. I did not do it.
Bailey shook his head. I believe you believe that statement.
I do, and most sincerely. I am telling the truth. I did not kill Jander.
But if you did not do it, and if no one else can possibly have done it, then... But wait. I am perhaps making an unwarranted assumption. Is Jander really dead, or have I been brought here under false pretenses?
The robot is really destroyed. It will be quite possible to show him to you if the legislature does not bar my access to him before the day is over, which I don't think they will do.
In that case, if you did not do it, and if no one else could possibly have done it, and if the robot is actually dead, who committed the crime?
Fastoff sighed.
I'm sure Daniil told you what I have maintained at the inquiry, but you want to hear it from my own
lips. That is right, Dr.
Fastoff. Well, then, no one committed the crime. It was a spontaneous event in the positronic flow along the brain paths that set up the mental freeze-out in Jander.
Is that likely?
No, it is not. It is extremely unlikely. But if I did not do it, then that is the only thing that can have happened.
Might it not be argued that there is a greater chance that you are lying than that a spontaneous mental freeze-out took place?
Many do so argue. But I happen to know that I did not do it, and that leaves only the spontaneous event as the possibility.
And you have had me brought here to demonstrate, to prove... that the spontaneous event did, in fact, take place?
Yes.
But how does one go about proving the spontaneous event? Only by proving it, it seems, can I save you, Earth, and myself.
In order of increasing importance, Mr. Bailey?
Bailey looked annoyed.
Well, then, you, me, and Earth.
I'm afraid, said Fastoff, that after considerable thought, I have come to the conclusion... that there is no way of obtaining such a proof.
17. Bailey stared at Fastoff in horror. No way?
No way. None.
And then, in a sudden fit of apparent abstraction, he seized the spicer and said,
You know, I am curious to see if I can still do the triple genuflection.
He tossed the spicer into the air with a calculated flip of the wrist. It somersaulted, and as it came down, Fastoff caught the narrow end on the side of his right palm, his thumb tucked down. It went up slightly and swayed and was caught on the side of the left palm. It went up again in reverse and was caught on the side of the right palm and then again on the left palm. After this third genuflection, it was lifted with sufficient force to produce a flip. Fastoff caught it in his right fist with his left hand nearby, palm upward. Once the spicer was caught, Fastoff displayed his left hand, and there was a fine sprinkling of salt in it. Fastoff said,
It is a childish display to the scientific mind, and the effort is totally disproportionate to the end, which is, of course, a pinch of salt, but the good Auroran host is proud of being able to put on a display. There are some experts who can keep the spicer in the air for a minute and a half, moving their hands almost more rapidly than the eye can follow. Of course, he added thoughtfully, Daniil can perform such actions with greater skill and speed than any human. I have tested him in this manner in order to check on the workings of his brain paths, but it would be totally wrong to have him display such talents in public. It would needlessly humiliate human spicists, a popular term for them, you understand, though you won't find it in dictionaries.
Bailey grunted.